like there's hardly a Sunday when we couldn't be gay for Wounded. Meanwhile, the world's peacemaker community mourns the death of Tom Fox, a Quaker who was trying to work for good in Iraq and was kidnapped, tortured, and killed. In Afghanistan, four United States military reported killed, at least two Afghani police officers also reported slain today as violence continues across the region. What's going on there and how is it justified? In our first hour today on Sunday Salon, we're going to be talking about the ultimate justification that's trotted out constantly about this: God. Does God love war? In our second hour, we're going to be talking about a war that nobody could love because it might exterminate everybody on the planet. That is to say, nuclear war. We narrowly avoided it, as it turns out, between Pakistan and India. And now the Bush administration is saying, nice, India, you can have all the nukes you want. Bad Pakistan, you can't. And what about Iran and North Korea? What is the world menace of nuclear weapons today? That topic in our second hour on Sunday Salon. Stay with us. This is Sunday Salon, heard every week from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, and on the web at kpfa.org. I'm Larry Bensky. Last night here in Berkeley, a packed house at King Junior High attended a dialogue between two of our guests this hour, Chris Hedges and Hamza Yousuf. They were talking about, does God love war? And they've been kind enough to share some of their time here with us this morning on Sunday Salon. Welcome to both of you. And also, by the way, we're going to be joined in a little while by combat photographer Kale Alford, who is one of four independent photojournalists whose work is present in a new book called Unembedded. Chris Hedges, I guess you're not in Rockford, Illinois anymore now that you've survived a night in Berkeley?
No, I fled to Berkeley. That's right. A bastion of sanity.
The allusion to Rockford, Illinois is to Chris Hedges' now famous commencement address, which he tried to give in 2003 to a college there in Illinois, and about which he writes in his most recent book, Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America, which is an autobiography, basically, of his spiritual and practical and thoughtful journey through the planet, a book I enjoyed very much, and I was quite disappointed to see how trashed it got in many reviews, but not really surprised, because I think what it did is trod on a lot of hooves of sacred cows, I think one might say.
Well, people didn't know what to make of it. It's very hostile to institutional religion, yet at the same time, certainly comes out of a very deep faith and belief. And I think it just sort of confused liberals and conservatives alike.
Well, they shouldn't be confused. I would recommend that they read it. We'll talk more about it during this hour. Hamza Yousuf is an American-born Muslim who converted to the Muslim religion at what age?
18.
And how long ago was that?
Well, it was approximately quite a while ago. Yeah.
60 or 70 years ago? No, you're not a venerable
Almost 30
elder.
Years.
Yeah. Almost 30 years. And he has founded something in Hayward about which I had not heard until I started seeing these very nice little cards and posters all over the community. Does God love war? An evening of conversation between you and Chris Hedges. What is the Zaytuna Institute?
Zaytuna Institute is actually a seminary, and we're attempting to really create a type of seminary that is rooted in the tradition of Islam, but is also recognizing the challenges of the modern period in which we're living in. So it's a pioneering adventure.
And it's a pioneering adventure in a time that calls for pioneers in the Muslim faith in this country, because right. As you and every one of our listeners, I'm sure, is well aware, There's a politically stoked controversy about the Muslim religion in this country, and it's unfortunately having the effect of making Muslims in general more unpopular and more suspicious, probably than any other religious tendency in this country right now.
To be fair to the U.S., I've spent quite a bit of time in Europe, and the situation's actually much worse in Europe. I think the American people have shown a type of resiliency against a lot of the propaganda. So, particularly, I mean, we're in the Bay Area, which is a good place to be. There are other areas, but I was just in Memphis, Tennessee, and I was pretty overwhelmed by the community. A large segment of peoples of other faith came out to hear the talk, a lot of the notables in the Memphis community, and I just felt a real genuine desire to understand. So, I think there is an immense amount of propaganda out there, and then there's also some real valid concerns, because the Islamic religion right now is... we're going through a very rough period. I mean, we've got some voices out there within the religion that are as frightening, and sometimes maybe even a little bit more frightening than some of the voices we have in the extreme Christian right here.
But anybody who thinks through this at all realizes that, Chris Hedges, there have always and eternally been extremists in every mode of thought. People who will take it and deform it and use it for their own egotistical and or political means. And to say that Muslim extremists or Christian extremists or Jewish extremists or any extremists are in any way typical of the people who follow the faith is on the face of it absurd. And yet there has grown up in this country a politically inspired, as I said, us versus them way of framing things, clash of civilizations, etc., your Huntingtons, your Lewis's, which has provided us with a very convenient substitute enemy for communism.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think that it's, as somebody who comes out of a religious tradition and graduated from seminary, when I look at these movements, whether they're in the Middle East, whether it's, you know, the nationalist Serb movement that I covered during the war in the former Yugoslavia, what these people create are civic religions, religions that intertwine the goals of the state with the goals of the divine. And in just basic theological terms, what this is a form of idolatry. When your God looks and speaks like you, when the power that you employ as a community or a nation becomes not only sanctioned, but willed and ordained by God, then I think you cross that line between, although you still speak in religious language, you cross that line into the worship of idols. And I think, nobody, no nation, and no religion is immune from that. We're certainly seeing within our own nation the rise of an idolatrous movement that wraps itself in the mantle of patriotic iconography and language, as well as Christian iconography and language.
But in this country, it's especially pernicious for many of us because it intertwines itself with an effective political machine.
Well, that's right. I mean, and there has been an alliance now made with this radical movement within the Christian right with very pernicious corporate interests. And this movement is not only very well funded and very well organized, but has created a parallel universe, whether it's in sort of so-called Christian schools or through so-called Christian broadcasting networks, people never have to step out of that system. They never have to hear other voices. They never have to endure self-criticism. And what that really is called, the best word for that is indoctrination. So we have tens of millions of people in this country who have been shut out from the mainstream. And that's why the movement calls on people to remove their children from public schools and are being indoctrinated in ideology, which at its core is about hatred and exclusion.
We have now been joined, as I mentioned we would be, by Cale Alford, who is one of the independent photographers whose work is present in a new book called Unembedded, published by Chelsea Green Press. Thank you for joining us this morning, Cale Alford.
Thanks for having me.
Maybe we can get your microphone turned on, and you can join us. Try again.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me.
Go ahead, Cale. Try now.
How's that?
That's better. Hi. Thank you very much. Cale Alford, I started off by mentioning the death and apparent torture of a member of the Christian Peacemakers team in Baghdad. Did you know Tom Fox by any chance?
I don't think I've met him, no. But I do know the Christian Peacemakers.
What are they doing there?
I don't know what they're doing there right now. They were there when I was in Baghdad throughout the bombing campaign, the U.S. bombing campaign. And I think they were there as witnesses, really.
What does witnessing mean?
I mean, I can't speak for them, but what I saw them do is go to hospitals. I saw them, you know, speak with families and just sort of record what they saw in Baghdad and write letters home to anyone who would listen to them.
You've spent a total of, I think it's 8 months there over the past 3 years or so?
Yeah, that's right.
These people like you were not living in the green zone behind big high walls with a lot of security guards.
Right. No, most journalists working in Iraq don't stay in the green zone. I don't know any journalists who do.
Oh, I read plenty of dispatches from people who obviously do.
Well, they certainly report from there, but I don't know if they're staying there now. Perhaps things have changed. But when I was there, journalists were staying in hotels.
Chris Hedges, you covered, I don't know how many wars and conflicts, Sarajevo, Central America, Iraq, Bosnia. Well, that's part of Sarajevo. Other places as well. Do you have a count? How many different?
Well, you know, a lot of times, because I was overseas for 20 years, I would get sent into places like, for instance, the Punjab for 6 weeks. I'm always a little reluctant to count that. I mean, but if you add all that together, you know, the civil war in Yemen, Algeria, probably about a dozen conflicts.
And to come back to our topic here today, you have written about that and religion by saying, if I could just read a couple of sentences here from Losing Moses on the Freeway. Religious authorities in the wars I covered willingly put their institutions in the service of nationalist or ethnic violence. They legitimized the abuse and murder of others outside the faith. They sanctified war. They turned their religious texts into venomous calls for death and vengeance. Christians, Jews, and Muslims were indistinguishable in championing ruthless crusades in the name of their faith. This was as true in the Middle East as in the Balkans. That's a very difficult thing, I would think, to internalize for somebody who's a person of faith.
Well, not really, because my father was a social activist, so was always...
And a minister.
And a minister. And, you know, a really interesting man in that he was a veteran of World War II, had deep personal piety. There was no alcohol in my house. I never heard him swear. We didn't work on the Sabbath. Yet at the same time, he had a passion for social justice, so that he was very involved in the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement. He died in 1995. The last part, a few years of his life, were in the gay rights movement. My uncle was gay, so he had a sensitivity to what it was to be a gay man in America. And in fact, when I went to university, there was no gay and lesbian organization at my university, so my father brought the gay speakers to my college.
And made you be the sponsor of
yes,
the gay and lesbian organization.
Yes, well, what happened was, as the gay and lesbian students spoke to him and said that they were too intimidated to go public and form an organization, a problem my father swiftly solved by taking me out to lunch and informing me that I had to found it. So I would walk into the dining hall, and the guy would take my little card for breakfast, lunch, or dinner and check it off and hand it back to me and go, faggot. Mm. So I made it my undergraduate mission to seduce his girlfriend. But that was my dad. So I understood the personal cost of taking a moral stand. And, of course, he had terrible problems within the institutional church, which is, you know, institutions, as Paul Tillich, the great theologian, wrote, all human institutions are inherently demonic, including the church. Institutions can never attain the morality of the individual. And I think the lesson that my father taught me was that when you make a moral choice, it entails risk. That's what it's about. And if it's not risky, it's probably not a moral choice. And I had to face this, as you mentioned, Rockford College, after I was booed off the stage for beginning my commencement address by saying this is a war of liberation, but it is a war of liberation by Iraqis against American occupation, and going on from there. It became a feeding frenzy with the right-wing trash talk media. Rush Limbaugh, the Wall Street Journal wrote an editorial. The Times felt pressured. They called me in and gave me a formal reprimand, a written reprimand, and told me to stop speaking about the war. And I'm not going to pretend that was an easy moment. Nobody likes to lose their job. It was uncomfortable. I was nervous. But as I sat in that office, I knew that I was faced with a choice. And the choice was I could be muzzled and further my career at the expense of my integrity. But to make that choice would be to betray my dad. And it was something I couldn't do.
In your book, this is another reason I recommend it to listeners, Losing Moses on the Freeway, the entire text with interspersed boldface notes about when people were booing and hicks and hissing and yelling
at you. My favorite is some woman who screamed out, "Atheist stranger." It's so visceral, but I think it explains how I appeared to them.
It's also very odd to me that in May 2003, which is when you were giving this speech, that they had not researched further who you were and what you were likely to say. But leaving that where it is, I wanted to ask you, Hamza Yousef, if you've seen the movie Syriana by any chance.
Yeah, I have.
What did you make of, and that's something else I want to recommend very strongly to our listeners, if they haven't seen it already. I think it's a brilliant piece of storytelling. Mm-hmm. It's not a documentary. It's a piece of storytelling. But what did you make of the young Muslims in that film who were discussing their feelings and their zeal and their grievousness and their sense of alienation, and eventually a couple of them become suicide attackers on a ship?
Well, I thought it was actually very accurate from that perspective. I mean, I spent 10 years in the Middle East, and I've been in situations of hearing conversations like that. Unfortunately, I mean, I think a lot of people here are entirely unaware of just how alienated and disenfranchised a lot of the people in the Arab world are, not only from their own governments, but from the world community. You know, I'll give you an example. Somebody defined enfranchisement as a community is only enfranchised at the point when the individual criminals amongst them, if they do anything, it's not projected onto the entire community. And I think that's a really solid way of determining whether or not people are enfranchised. And collective guilt, you know, I mean, we've heard over and over again, 15 out of the 19 hijackers were Saudi Arabians, as if all of Saudi Arabia, you know, support or are potentially hijackers. The idea of, you know, Arabs, our embassies demand that they get fingerprinted before they can get visas. Now, I don't have a problem if they want to do that across the board for anybody applying for a visa to the United States, but the idea of selecting, you know, one religion or one group of people to criminalize the entire people, that's a sense of alienation. I mean, people are going to feel alienated. So the Muslims right now are the out-group. Arnold Toynbee, in a really brilliant essay in 1947, said that long before communism was the bugbear of Western civilization, we had Islam to fill that role. And he actually perceived that in the future, Islam would reemerge. Once communism was removed, Islam would reemerge as this communism. And Gorbachev said, when the evil empire was coming to an end, he said, "I'm going to do something very, very terrible for you Americans. I'm going to take away your enemy." And I think that's, you know, Chris, the title of his book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Enemies also give us meaning. You know, having an other to project our own dark side onto is very important for people to have their psychic integrity when they're living in denial and projection.
Cale Alford, one of the words that to me is a key to the epic that we've been living in and over the past 4 or 5 years is the word Fallujah, and we come back to it again and again on this program when we discuss this topic. The first time I understood what had gone on there in the first assault on Fallujah, the word Guernica came to my mind, and I thought that that's what it had to be remembered as, but it's been very difficult to report out of there and for us to get much, if any, kind of images and information. I'm looking now at a photograph you took in April of 2003 of the city burning, essentially, and eventually in the second assault, it was basically destroyed. This is a city of 300,000 or 400,000 people. Nobody is quite sure how many lived there originally. What can, when you went there and you were able to interact with people, this whole question of a religious approach to what's going on, or lining up sides as according to faith. Was that a factor any longer in how people were thinking, feeling, and acting?
Well, when I was in Fallujah and Ramadi in the Al-Anbar province, it was not the place that it is now. I mean, it hadn't yet been attacked by the Americans. It hadn't gone through those two offensives. And I was really welcome there, and it was not, our discussions were not so much about religion as they were about sort of daily concerns of what it meant to be occupied, what was going to happen next to Iraq, what sort of jobs people were going to have. That area is full of people who work in, who are merchants, or who have their own construction companies and had gotten lots of contracts from the government in the past, and they were concerned that they were concerned about their business and about supporting their families and their extended families in that very traditional tribal area.
But what can be in the minds, and we know what can be in the minds because we've had a number of Iraqi people on this program and other correspondents who've been there, in a place like Sadr City, which again is under some sort of combat today with a lot of loss of life, with bombs going off in a marketplace and mortars. And then I look at a picture of the Iraqi equivalent of a bridal shower. You have these very happy, celebrating women and families, beautiful, smiling, going off in a car. When a sense of elementary, everyday safety is missing from people and they can't go through even the most happy of rituals, what's happening to the society?
Well, I think that's the single most powerful factor really at work in Iraq today is how people feel that in their everyday lives there is not a sense of security or predictability, and they can't, you know, someone in Iraqi I met this weekend told me that his family in Baghdad, they kiss each other goodbye every time they walk out of the house. Mm. And that's what living in Iraq is like today. And I mean, that's a terrifying state to live in. And I think that's, again and again, the mantra I hear there from people is, you know, there's no security, there's no security, there's no security. And that's, I think that affects people on a very fundamental level that those of us who've been exposed to war can understand.
That's Kale Alford. She is one of four independent photojournalists who are represented in the new book, Embedded, with magnificent photographs.
Unembedded.
Unembedded. It's early in the morning. Published by Chelsea Green Press with some really striking, striking photographs. Also joining us here on Sunday Salon today is Hamza Yousuf of the Zaytuna Institute in Hayward, a Muslim theologian, and Chris Hedges, author of most recently Losing Moses on the Freeway. Chris Hedges, does the word Sarajevo come to your mind when you hear what Kale Alford was just saying?
Of course, and you know, when you ask the question about how people go about their daily lives, that was one of the most moving parts of being in Sarajevo. The fact that people realized that going about their daily life became an act of resistance. You would walk into an office in the presidential palace, and that area around the presidential palace was one of the most dangerous areas in the city. It was shelled constantly by the Serbs, those streets around the palace and the palace itself. And you would find people, their phones may not have worked. They had to walk through shell fire and sniper fire. They didn't have running water. They certainly didn't have enough to eat. Their family was cowering in a basement back home, but they would be sitting in their office in a coat and tie. And those moments were always deeply moving for me because it was a statement of being, a statement of dignity, a statement of resistance, right, in that we can continue to be human beings even in the midst of this slaughterhouse that the Serbs have created for us. And it was, you know, I can't tell you how moving it was for those of us who were there covering the war, as well as the fact that it was a reminder of the human cost and human tragedy that war is.
Hamza Yousuf, one of the ways, of course, in the Muslim world that people try to maintain a sense of normalcy is through the daily prayers.
Right.
And the idea that mosques have now become a place that is under attack,
right,
which of course did not start with whoever's blowing up each other's Sunni,
sure,
and Shiite mosques. One of the things that happened in Fallujah as the United States military attacked it is they went right for the mosque,
right,
saying that, well, these are places where
resistance,
yeah, which of course is another way of talking about a community and spiritual center.
Right.
And they went right at them, which must have had an alienating effect that'll last for generations.
Well, one of the things, just, you know, Fallujah is a very interesting place. Historically, Fallujah was probably one of the most difficult cities, even during the British occupation in the 20s. The Fallujans were known for just not tolerating occupation. In fact, one of the Fallujan, the heroes of Fallujah was a notable who actually shot one of the British commanders point blank because he insulted him. So Saddam gave them a lot of contracts, like you mentioned, because that was the way that he controlled them, was through money. You know, we went in there with, our military went in there with no knowledge of what these people were like. And one of the things about Muslims is that occupation is occupation, and they believe that it's a religious duty to defend their land against occupation, any occupation. And so the idea of calling them terrorists, the idea of, you know, not recognizing that they, in fact, Bush actually at one point said, you know, I'd probably be doing the same thing if somebody did that to us. I mean, you know, in one of his moments of brilliance. It's very tragic. But, and I would like to say also the idea of, you know, their security. The Prophet Muhammad actually said, wake up in the morning and never expect to see the evening, and go to bed at night, never expect to see the morning. And so that's actually a spiritual practice within the Muslim community, to just be aware of our mortality. We're on a spectrum of security. You know, I mean, all of us are one breath away from death.
But that's an intensely un-American way of looking at things, Chris Hedges, as you point out in your book. We're supposed to go to bed dreaming of the riches that we will begin to get on the morrow, and wake up in the morrow saying, how the heck am I going to get more stuff today?
Well, that's our national sickness.
You predicted, and you, of course, weren't the only one, and probably one of the main reasons you made the audience in Rockford, Illinois, so uncomfortable in May 2003, is you said exactly what was about to happen through the United States intrusion there. Why don't you just read those couple of sentences for us from that speech?
The real injustice is the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land. The brutal and corrupt dictatorships we fund in the Middle East will mean that we will not rid the extremists who hate us with bombs. Instead, we will swell their ranks. Once you master a people by force, you depend on force for control. In your isolation, you begin to make mistakes. Fear engenders cruelty, cruelty, fear, insanity, and then paralysis. In the center of Dante's circle, the damned remained motionless. We have blundered into a nation we know little about and are caught between bitter rivalries and competing ethnic groups and leaders we do not understand. We are trying to transplant a modern system of politics invented in Europe, characterized, among other things, by the division of earth into independent secular states based on national citizenship in a land where the belief in a secular civil government is an alien creed. Iraq was a cesspool for the British when they occupied it in 1917. It will be a cesspool for us as well. And let me just end by, someone shouts out from the crowd, God bless America.
Chris Hedges.
I have to go.
I know you do, and we're going to let you go. Chris Hedges is on his way to the airport. He's going to listen on cell phone, or try to. And we're going to take listener phone-ins now with our two remaining guests here in the studio, and Chris Hedges on his way flying back home. Thank you very much for coming out here and being with us. We hope to talk to you again. He has a book coming out shortly on the religious right in this country, and we'll hope to have him back at that point. We're going to invite our listeners to join us in this conversation now. Our toll-free number from wherever you may be is 1-800-958-9008. That's 1-800-958-9008. Or you can send us email, sundaysalon@kpfa.org. That's one word, sundaysalon@kpfa.org. And we'll be right back. Stay tuned. listening to Sunday Salon. This hour we're talking about the situation about religion and faith and war. And your phone calls are up next and your emails. Our first caller is Dave in Los Angeles. Dave, thanks for joining us on Sunday Salon.
Thank you, Larry. I want to ask your guests and also especially the Islam theologian about Bush. You know, Milosevic died recently, and if you compare him to Bush, they both were manipulators of their country and the people, you know, from the nation, calling themselves on the name of patriotism. And they started these illegal wars, both of them, and butchered Muslims. And Milosevic has been tried as a war criminal, while Bush is touted as a leader of the Western world, free world and all that. So I don't see any difference between the two. So shouldn't be Bush be also be a war criminal and tried in the Hague?
Well, they've got a vacancy there now. That trial took 4 years, and we're going to try to get Chris Hedges back on, because I'd like his take on this, of course, because he covered that conflict. But the idea of a trial for somebody, an international body, passing judgment on someone, but taking 4 years to do it. As they say, justice delayed is justice denied, and although the reverse of that is just take the guy out and hang him the minute you capture him, the idea of putting somebody through the kind of process that Slobodan Milosevic was undergoing struck many people as farcical.
Right. Well, I think Ramsey Clark, who was at the Nuremberg trials as a young lawyer and later became our attorney general under Johnson, was actually involved in the trials, the war crime trials of George Bush Sr. for the Gulf War I. And he was actually, by a tribunal of international judges, he was actually considered a war criminal. So that did happen. I mean, part of the problem here in the U.S. is that we act unilaterally, and we don't recognize international bodies. In fact, you know, if you look at what happened at Abu Ghraib, I mean, there are really slaps on the wrist in terms of what happened. And you end up getting the people at the very bottom are the ones taken to account, when accountability should go right up to the top.
Chris Hedges, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Your thoughts on the Slobodan Milosevic situation?
Well, I think Sheikh Hamza hit it on the head there. You know, the hypocrisy of it. I mean, I certainly, you know, I covered Iraq, you know, in especially northern Iraq with the Kurds, but also with the Shia in the south during the reign of Saddam Hussein. I know what a murderer he is and what a tyrant he was. Yet, if we want to use international bodies to seek justice against tyrants and against war criminals, then it can't be selective. It can't be those who we find politically convenient to attack while we protect other criminals who have been in our pay. One thinks, for instance, of Mobutu in the Congo, or even, I think, you know, people like Henry Kissinger or McNamara or others. So it's the hypocrisy that renders the entire process hollow. Sadly, because I think that there is a place for international justice, but we have worked very hard to make sure that those organizations don't function.
And of course, there are a lot of people who say that the trial of Saddam Hussein, which resumed in some shape today, can't conceivably be anything like a fair one because of the auspices under which it's going on, and the laws, and the way it was, the tribunal was created, etc. Cale Alford, this sense, again, I'm calling on you here as somebody who spent time on the ground and well outside the green zone in Iraq, this sense that justice, in the sense of the application of some code of laws, can be some sort of remedy or some sort of civil glue, if you will, that helps hold a society together. Did you see that in the minds of Iraqis at all?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that Iraqis have a very strong sense and awareness of justice. And I, from what I know about my time in the Muslim world, I think that's an important part of the Muslim faith, and certainly of the Christian faith, where I was raised. And I think that the frustration with the injustice that followed the American invasion of Iraq, in the sense that people really weren't being rewarded in the ways they were told they'd be rewarded for, you know, putting up with an invasion and not fighting back. It left people in really very, very frustrated. And I think that a profound sense of injustice is a big part of what is shaping the resistance in Iraq and is shaping the way people are now viewing the United States.
But of course, Chris Hedges and our other guest here, who you called Sheikh, is that a proper way to address?
Hamza, you can just refer to me as Hamza.
Okay, Hamza. The sense of justice is embedded and codified in many ways, in many cultures. Some of it is tribal, some of it is religious, some of it is civil. Iraq is not a place that was lacking in such structures for many centuries before Saddam Hussein was on the planet. And there should be a way to recreate it now, should there not, without it having to go through professors at NYU Law School?
Well, you know, I think the problem is that everything is perverted by the occupation. You know, it is very similar in my view to, you know, what happened in the West Bank and Gaza. And that occupation authority, which has the power and the means of force used to exert their will, means that nothing like justice will ever occur in Iraq, because if an act of justice were to actually be promulgated that went against the interests of the occupation authorities, it would be crushed. So when the Americans talk on one side of their mouth about justice, the reality is that it's convenient. It's only justice when it's convenient to their interests, and that's not justice.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that about Iraq's history. According to the book, The History of Bombing, the first rules of engagement were actually codified in Kufa, Iraq, in the 8th century by a jurist known as Abu Hanifa. And in that codification was the prohibition of killing non-combatants, of tearing down trees, of poisoning wells, harming livestock. War, you know, the Romans said bellus licet, war makes everything permissible. And war, in essence, is a criminal activity. It's the licensing of murder, and rarely is it in self-defense. I mean, most of the human wars have been criminal wars. And then there's always paradoxes, even in World War II, where it was clearer when you had, you know, the Axis powers versus the Allied powers. Nonetheless, the Allies, like Britain, were colonizing at the very same time large numbers of people, and quite ruthlessly, the French were controlling North Africa at the time. So, you know, trying to get out of melodrama, of painting things as black and white, is very important for us as human beings. America has an immense amount of good in it, but I think until we begin to really look at this dark side of our culture and civilization, we're just not going to go anywhere.
John in Laguna Hills, thank you for joining us on Sunday Salon.
Hello, yes, good morning.
Morning. Hi, John.
Good morning. My name is, actually, my proper name is Jahangir Golestan, and I'm Iranian Muslim. And I've been away from Iran for over 38 years, and I have traveled in France for 10 years, 10 years also in England, and I've been fortunate also to live in America for 17 years because I have a beautiful Christian wife that we really have a bit of challenge at the beginning from a different culture, but I'm so happy that our faith made us to live together, and we have learned so much about one another culture. First of all, I would like to congratulate for your program, because I think what is the problem with the Western world, with our friends, American and rest of the world, I think is due to lack of misunderstanding and really not really understanding the Muslim world. And I think in my opinion, religion is not that I would say that because I'm Muslim, better than Christianities or better than the Jews or better than the Baha'is. I think as a religion is a personal choice of the family that we should really have respect for one another. And it's so sad to see that people are condemning each other's religion. I really have a tremendous amount of respect for the Jews, for the Christians, and I have no doubt in my mind that I would say the Muslims are better than the Christians, or vice versa.
Okay, Chris Hedges, thank you very much for calling. You deal with these issues insightfully and extensively and eloquently in both of your books that we've talked about here today, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning and Losing Moses on the Freeway. And if I could encapsulate your thought, religion is for you a way of getting out of self and selfishness and a way of contacting a greater love.
Yes. You know, I think that having spent so many years of my life living in other cultures around other faiths, I learned that, you know, great men and women of virtue and courage, moral courage, rise within all cultures and all faiths to battle the oppressor and fight on behalf of the oppressed, that no religion, certainly our own, no nation has a monopoly on that virtue. I think it also has been striking to me that every culture in its own way has struggled to give words or grapple with the existence of the transcendent. And I think that God did not reveal him or herself to one people, one nation. Nobody has an exclusive knowledge of that transcendence. And I think that's the greatest testament for me to the reality of God. We all struggle in our own ways to go forward and grapple with the great ethical and moral and dilemmas, the mystery of human life. And I've learned so much from Islam. I've learned so much from Judaism, having lived in Israel, from Hinduism, you know, that the more contact I have with people who don't look and speak like me, the greater has become the depth and power of my own faith.
I wanted to ask you, Cale Alford, the same question I asked Sister Helen Prejean, who was here a couple of weeks ago, talking with us. She, of course, is the world-famous crusader against the death penalty. And she also is a longtime resident and Catholic worker in New Orleans. And I asked her, as I've asked her before, what happens to your faith when you see things like Hurricane Katrina devastate the community and the people with whom you worked and lived for so long? What happens to your faith when people are executed despite your strong feelings that this is the ultimate injustice? What happens to your faith? And she said to me, all the things you're talking about are not a God problem. They're a people problem. They're people who've gotten themselves out of sync with God. It's not that God is encouraging, allowing, or permitting this. It's people are, I'm paraphrasing what she said here, people have gotten themselves out of tune with God and God's will and what we should be doing on this planet. And the question I wanted to ask you is, are you personally a person of faith and belief? And if so, or even if not, what happens to you spiritually and psychically when you witness the kinds of things you witness as you're taking these very striking pictures?
Well, I always felt that my opportunity to work in Iraq was just that. It was an opportunity, and that there was going to be, I didn't know how it would change me exactly. I wasn't thinking so personally when I chose to go there. It certainly did change me, though. Though I've covered conflicts in other places and I've done this for almost a decade, my experience in Iraq was very profound for me personally. But I would just like to say that one of the most moving things about being in conflict zones and being around people and watching them live their lives in spite of whatever horrible things are happening, are watching their expressions of faith, not only in their God, but in their sort of love for being alive. And I found it very it gave me, when I, by the time I left Iraq, I wanted nothing but to sort of live and to live well. And I think that many people going through those horrific experiences do come away with that sense. And I certainly found that to be true there.
What about the question of your own? Are you a believing person in an organized or disorganized religion?
I'm a believing person in a disorganized way, yes.
Okay. That'll be good enough. Oh, we have an email here, Hamza, about the appearance last night of you and Chris Hedges. Is that available anywhere? The Jane in Berkeley wants to know, is that available or will it be available anywhere on the web?
Yeah, it will be on www.zaytuna.org. Zaytuna. It's also going to be aired on KPFA.
Ah.
And
when? Do we know?
You know, you'd have to ask somebody. You've got connections here, I think.
So. I wouldn't assume that I could find anything like that out in this place.
And it will be made available, I think, on DVD also.
Great. We'll be looking forward to that. And I will, of course, announce it.
And I would really recommend Chris Hedges. But both those books are really, as you know, worth reading.
They're definitely worth reading in many ways. Suzanne in Forestville, thank you for joining us on Sunday Salon.
And thank you very much for the program. Politics, no matter where it is and throughout history, has been a dirty and oftentimes criminal endeavor. We can certainly see that today in the United States, but it just appears to me and a lot of other folks that amongst many Muslims, that they've reached unsurpassed heights of murderous brutality within their politics. When you disagree with somebody, you just blow them up.
Are you at all familiar with a phenomenon on this planet called World War I?
Yes, absolutely.
And how can you say that what's going on in the Muslim world today, I mean, if you just want to quantify it.
Yeah, no, it's quantified.
If you just want to quantify it, the sense, and there weren't any Muslims involved there to my knowledge either, the sense of absolutely boundless, insane slaughter that went on in that trench warfare month after month, year after year, I just don't think, I mean, no matter what you may think about what's going on in the world today, that you can forget that.
No, I'm not forgetting it, Larry, but what I'm saying is in the name of their God, in the name of religion, Shiites blowing up Sunnis, Sunnis blowing up, I mean, it's a daily thing. In the name of religion, World War I was not in the name of religion, and I do think you have to address that.
All right, Chris Hedges, address it.
Well, first of all, in World War I, German churches and the British churches and the French churches were solidly behind the war and lent their religious authority to the prosecution of the war and the demonization of the other, number one. Number two, we have killed far more Iraqis in Iraq through high explosive devices and weapons of industrial warfare than Iraqis have killed a fellow Iraqis. And number three, I don't look at these conflicts as religious conflicts. They are conflicts, they're essentially tribal conflicts for power, much as we saw in the Balkans, and they wrap themselves in a religious veneer. I think that, again, is the mistake of conflating civic religion, religion that uses the language of the belief system to justify violence, and real religion, which, of course, has a kind of depth and profundity and struggles with ethics and values. I think they're two different systems, and I think it's a mistake to confuse them.
Could I add to that just, and I think Kyle would confirm this because she was in Iraq. I think one of the things that's so extraordinary about a lot of these people is the immense hospitality they have towards other people, towards guests, that what is amplified is actually a minority, and they are a minority. But they are amplified, and the vast majority of people, you know, if you got, Ed Bradley asked me once, you know, he had told me he'd just been to Egypt, and then he asked me, why do they hate us? And I said, well, you were just in Egypt, you know, did they hate you? Did they spit on you? And he said, no, they actually treated me really well. And I said, well, that's the reality. You're just dealing with a lot of human beings that are in incredibly difficult situations. I mean, I don't think people have any idea what it is like to be in Iraq right now, a calamity that we are completely responsible for. I mean, you know, you can talk about Saddam's previous crimes, but his crimes were largely
They were rational in a Stalinist type of way. He dealt with rebellion very ruthlessly. But Iraqis were living their lives. And we've gone in there and created this. You know, there's a tradition in Islam that civil strife is asleep. And may God curse the one who wakes it up. So, I just think we need to think about that at a deeper level. And, I just feel very strongly about it because I've spent 10 years of my life in the Arab world. And, I've always been treated with immense respect.
Well, you know, the thing that comes back to my mind over and over again as a father of a relatively young child, she's 9 now, as I see you, the photographs in your book of so many children who are in situations of pain and suffering and loss, K.L. Alford, as well as in trying to live their own lives and celebrate and be children. Chris Hedges, you write about this very eloquently, as usual. The fact that wars don't end when wars end, even if they end, and conflicts don't end when conflicts end, even no matter how they end. They carry psychic and social and sociological scars down through generations. And when you're talking, as I think very justifiably right now, Hamza, about the situation in Iraq, people have to remember there are 25 million people, more or less, in that country. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many families that divides up into.
And over half are under 20.
And under half are under 20. And this is their youth. This is their childhood.
Yeah.
For all the things that we are doing as families and with young people here in this country right now, they can't do hardly any of them, and the few that they try to do are always under...
You know, one of the Pentagon spokesmen the other day was interviewed and said, things have changed in Iraq. Women are going to school. Iraq has one of the highest level of pre-war level of female attendees to college. Do you know? So it's this type of just absolute disinformation and ignorance that goes on.
Chris Hedges, talk for a second. I know you are concerned about your children, and we may be losing you on the cell phone as you get closer to the airport. But you end your book, latest book, Losing Moses on the Freeway. We may be losing you on the freeway, for that matter, about the idea of generations and generational change. You spoke earlier very eloquently about your father and his legacy to you as a social activist and as a nonconformist. What are your children saying to you now? What do they know about conflicts and things like Iraq, and what are you saying back?
Well, you know, I essentially do what my dad did to me, which is drag my children off to all sorts of events, and they may not get all of it, but the fact that they were there, I can remember as a young boy going to hear Pete Seeger sing in an anti-war demonstration around the Capitol in Albany. All of it is a way of, I mean, when I spoke at Princeton for the Canton Conference with Colin Powell, I took my son, who was 14, and I said, now, Colin Powell, I explained that Colin Powell had lied to the American people and justified the war, and that when everyone stood and applauded, I was not going to stand and applaud. And so the entire room stood in a standing ovation, and I and my young son sat there in the front row, not applauding and not standing. And that was what my father passed on to me, and that is what I'm attempting to pass on to my son. You know, I once won an award that was actually the Overseas Press Club Award for my book, presented by Henry Kissinger. And I said, we're going to go listen to Henry Kissinger. And of course, I explained who he was, and I explained who Victor Haro was. And I said, and I'm not going to applaud, and I'm not going to stand, but we're going to listen to him because you learn more from your enemies than you often do from your friends. And if you can't counter the arguments that your enemies use, then you fail. And so we will listen respectfully, but again, we will not honor him. So it's those moments that I hope and pray that my father gave me that I'm giving to my children.
Well, thank you very much for that thought, Chris Hedges. And of course, people in the Bay Area and around the country have an opportunity this coming week and weekend to take their children, as we have our daughter ever since she was a tiny infant in a stroller, to demonstrations, to rallies, to commemorations of the United States invasion and occupation of Iraq. There's the one in San Francisco. There are other ones I'm going to be talking about in a few minutes in Walnut Creek and Palo Alto and Santa Rosa, all around. And it's always encouraging to me to see how many families do come out to these things. Do you think that the Muslim presence in this country, Hamza, finally, as we're running out of time here, is something that can be, I don't want to use the word integrated, but maybe I will, into these activities, these rather traditional peace activities? Because if you think back to previous conflicts and previous demonstrations in this country and rallies and mass mobilizations, Muslims weren't a big part of it, but of course now we're supposed to be at war with them. Talk for a minute about how that plays out.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I think a lot of Muslims, particularly immigrants, are just very worried about being seen as a fifth column, about being seen as a threat, and when they're come out in an anti-war stance, they're very worried about that people will see that as that their real allegiance, for instance, is with the Iraqis or something like that. But there's a lot of courageous people, people like Hatem Bezan, who you know, that are out there and they're speaking up. Another aspect of the Muslim community is about 40% of American Muslims are African American, and African American people are very very well aware of the struggles.
They've been there.
Yeah, they've been there. And so I think part of it is creating coalitions. The Muslims are a somewhat provincial community, and it's time to reach out. There's a lot of good allies out there. There's a lot of people that are very concerned. And I found it very heartwarming that so many people have reached out to the Muslim community. And I think the Muslim community needs to reciprocate.
Are you on your way back at any foreseeable time to Iraq, Gail Alford?
I would love to go back to Iraq, and I'm sure that I will. I don't know when that will be. For me, you know, I don't want to. I won't put myself in that position. It's an incredibly dangerous place to be, unless I think that I can do something useful. And I'm always looking for some useful way to go back. So I hope.
Of course, it has had a mortality rate of journalists that is one of the highest in history.
Well, it's surpassed now the number of journalists killed in the Vietnam War, and most of those journalists are Iraqi. They're not foreigners, and most of the people kidnapped in Iraq are Iraqis.
And we never hear about
that. And we don't hear about that.
We never hear about that. Chris Hedges, thank you very much. Quickly, you have a new book coming about the right-wing church in this country. What's it called? When's it coming out?
It's called American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America, and it'll be out in September.
American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War in America, just in time for the fall election. Thank you very much.
Well, that was the idea, Larry.
I guess it was.
Let's hope they fall in the election as well.
Chris Hedges, former New York Times reporter, with a distinguished career as a war correspondent and author of the two books we've been discussing here, Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America, which is a kind of an autobiography as well as a meditation on religion, and earlier, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Thank you for joining us in studio and on cell phone, Chris Hedges.
Thank you very much.
And thank you to our two in-studio guests as well.
Thank you.
Cale Alford is one of the four photographers in the, I want to say beautiful because it is beautiful, but beauty, of course, is...
hauntingly beautiful.
Hauntingly beautiful. Thank you very much. A hauntingly beautiful book of photographs, along with Gaith Abdul Ahad, Thorne Anderson, and Rita Leisner. The book is called Unembedded, and it's published by Chelsea Green Press. And once again, to get a hold of and look further into the Zaytuna Institute in Hayward, you can go to their website, www.zaytuna.org. Our guest, Hamza Youssef, thank you both very much
thank
for being
you.
With us.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a few minutes, talking about something even more menacing than the invasion and occupation of Iraq, and that is the worldwide spread of nuclear weapons. Stay tuned. This is Sunday Salon. I'm Larry Bensky.